This is the Popmatic Podcast for
April 6th, 2016.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Shall I compare thee to a winter night?
Whoa. I'm just letting you go. Yeah, you're going down.
How much is going to go?
Hey, yeah.
How much are you, him, for thou art more temperate?
The Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian, and joining me today are
Amanda,
Mike,
E.E. Jeremy,
lowercase, right?
Yeah, I do.
I should have said Jeremy E.E., I guess, because that's my
J.E.
That's my last initial.
If you have not caught on already, April is National Poetry Month, so on this episode, we get poetic. You may be asking yourself how you can celebrate Poetry Month. Well, how about order a free National Poetry Month poster and display it at work or school?
Sign up for a poem a day and annoy your coworkers with it every morning.
Sign up for Teach This Poem, a weekly series for teachers.
Memorize a poem. I hope it's a short one.
Create an anthology of your favorite poems on poets.org.
Encourage a young person to participate in the Dear Poet Project because not everyone gives up on their dreams.
Buy a book of poetry from your local bookstore if you can find the poetry section. Ha!
Review these concrete examples of how poetry matters in the United States today.
Learn more about poets and poetry events in your state. I hope you don't live in the South.
Burn, y'all. Ask your governor or mayor to stop.
just stop it.
They have nothing better to do with their time.
Yeah. Ask your governor or mayor to stop wasting their time fiddling and make a proclamation in support of National Poetry Month.
Attend a poetry reading at a local university, bookstore, cafe, or library. Man, hang out with the beats and smoke a cigarette with your beret.
And then you can read a poem at open mic night. It's a great way to meet other writers in your area and find out about your local poetry writing community and practice your finger snaps.
Yeah.
I think this is the same thing. Start a poetry reading group.
Rob a grave. Write an exquisite corpse poem with your friends.
Chalk a poem at the end of the sidewalk with Shel Silverstein.
Chalk a poem?
That's what it says.
That is what it says. Chalk a poem.
I'd like to deepen my daily experience by reading Edward Hirsch's essay, How to Read a Poem.
The others were so general, that's very specific.
It is oddly specific.
Ask the United States Post Office to issue more stamps celebrating poets. That's what lonely people do.
I want more poets on my stamps.
Poetry is totally vindicated now.
Slowly kill yourself by recreating a poet's favorite food or drink by following his or her recipe.
Because they never drink rowdy stuff.
Cigarettes and whiskey.
Drink alcohol or stick your head in the oven.
Whoa. So, anyway, read about different poetic forms.
Love suicide.
Holy moly.
I've gotten all the great ones. I'm so happy.
Couplets, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going to read a poem titled Poem.
Meta.
Totally meta. Deep.
Celebrate National Poem in Your Pocket Day. Don't make jokes. April 21st, 2016. The idea is simple. Select a poem you love, carry it with you, and then share it with coworkers, family, and friends, and wait for them to call the police.
None of them would like my poem.
Yeah, I hope they know you, otherwise you're going to be a stalker. You gotta hear this poem. It's great. Stop running.
It's amazing. Slow down.
Subscribe to American Poets Magazine or a small press poetry journal.
I like that one.
There you go.
Okay.
Why not?
Why watch Rachel Eliza Griffiths POP parentheses poets on poetry videos.
Watch or read Caroline Forsh's talk, Not Persuasion, but Transport, the Poetry of Witness.
You get these really specific ones.
I do. I like the specific things.
Like the movie Witness?
I saw one today.
Read or listen to Mike Dottie's talk.
Mark Dottie's talk.
The Tide of Voices, Why Poetry Matters Now.
Hmm.
Read Allen Ginsberg's classic essay about Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, or just read Leaves of Grass, dummy.
This is my favorite one by far, gang. Watch a poetry movie. I watch 300 movies a year. I can't think of one poetry movie.
Dead Poet Society.
Dead Poet Society. There's probably a Sylvia.
That's not really. I guess it kind of.
Stick your head in the oven and watch Dead Poet Society.
It says poet in the.
Gross.
This Sylvia Plath biopic, right?
Yeah,
for sure.
Didn't James Franco play Allen Ginsberg?
A lot of movies about the Beats.
Okay.
Well, I might sign up for a poetry class or workshop.
Hey, there's one at the library, directed by our friend Paul. Check it out. Get ready for Mother's Day by making a card featuring a line of poetry.
Just one line.
Just one line.
Quote the Raven, nevermore. This makes no sense.
Happy Mother's Day, Mom.
What are you trying to tell me?
Dear Mom, your friend from the 80s said you like lines. So here. No, that's stupid.
Death is the mother of beauty.
Necessity is the mother of invention, Bob.
Read the first chapter of Muriel
Rukeyser's.
Read some poems. Book Life of Poetry. Inspiring book. Read it.
Muriel's book.
Read the first chapter of Muriel Hemingway's. Rukeyser?
In all seriousness, you know, Third Man Records started out their own they started their own printing press, and they have their own poetry imprint. They're printing some really cool, awesome poets, and you can get those at the library. I'll put a link in the show note.
I'm glad we took that so seriously.
Start poetically cold?
I can poetically start poetically cold. I grew up with Dr. Seuss, so in my world, I feel like poetry should rhyme all of the time. But if it doesn't, then it needs to have a good reason why, or I cry. I had to do that. Okay, and then I came across this book by John Cage. It doesn't rhyme, finger quotes, but it's John Cage, and since when does he ever do anything that's, you know, normal? So...
Oh, wait, you're talking about John Cage?
I am, Brian's talked about John Cage, right? Yeah, okay, I thought that he's mentioned him.
I don't think I've ever talked about John Cage.
Well...
I think he did.
Maybe.
We're going to say he did. Yeah. So.
I just saw John Cage, and I was like, oh, Brian's talking about John Cage.
In our alternative history, Brian has talked about John Cage in the past. Cage passed away in 1992, and he's really best known for his avant-garde 20th century music with pieces like 4 minutes and 33 seconds.
Oh,
and
we could hear a clip right now.
That was magical. So he also did prepared piano work where he sticks things like screws and nuts and bolts into the strings of piano to change how it sounds when the strings are plucked. And he loved composing by chance, basing many of his compositions, as well as much of his life, on the I Ching, which is known in English as the Book of Changes. And it was originally a Chinese divination manual that was created during the Western Zhou period, which is approximately 1000 BC. For those of you keeping score at home. So in 1965, Cage put together his thoughts and called it Diary, How to Improve the World. You Will Only Make Matters Worse. He described this as a mosaic of ideas, statements, words, and stories. And each day he used chance to determine how many parts he would write and how many words would be in each part. But he did set a minimum at 100 words a day, because it would take a long time to write a book if your chance kept telling you one word a day. So at least 100 words a day. Then he also used chance to determine how it was physically written and presented on the page, i.e. what font, what color, what spacing. So he had to know kind of what printing press options he had when he published this, but it did kind of turn out really cool. For me, this reads more like poetry than prose. I have an example here, a brief snippet of his text. Project: discover way to translate Far Eastern texts so Western men can read orientally. Communication? Bakarashi. Words without syntax, each word polymorphic. He wanted me to agree that the piano tuner and the piano maker have nothing to do with it, the composition. The younger ones had said, whoever makes the stretcher isn't separate from the painting. It doesn't stop there either. So it seems like his works are kind of random thoughts put together. And Cage actually used this work for various lectures he gave over the course of his career, which caused the piece to kind of grow and change. And the new edition that was just published by Celio that the library has includes all of the different iterations of the text as it grew and evolved. I'm not sure this is something that you sit down and just kind of read straight through.
I would.
Except unless you're Brian. But I enjoyed exploring the different sections and kind of seeing what jumped out at me. And in the end, isn't that what poetry is supposed to do? Especially if it doesn't rhyme.
Okay, so my partner and I, who've been together for 10 years, our very first date, which was in the pizza pub in Clarion, PA, which is where my parents used to go on dates. I don't know how this came up, but...
Personal anecdote for Brian.
Talking about music, and she's like, you know, but some contemporary just composers go too far. Like, you know, like the one guy, he just composed a piece and you just sit at the piano and you don't even play. I'm just like, so you're dissing John Cage at our first date. This is obviously going nowhere. 10 years later. Never let her live it down. Sorry.
That was
selfish and mic hogging.
That's amazing.
I recommend all John Cage's books, whether they're classified in poetry or prose, mm-hmm. are like poetry. There's all this beautiful font work. It's great.
There's a – I can't remember the name of the piece. It's like as slow as possible or something. It's like some piece that he wrote that's intended to be played very slowly. And they're somewhere in Germany, I think. They're playing.
Isn't there like one note a year?
They're playing it. It's scheduled to be performed over the next, like, well, at this point, it's like 490 years.
Oh, yeah.
It was like a 500-year project. And the first performance of it was like they went and there's this gigantic pipe organ somewhere. And they went and they turned the organ on. And like that was the first performance. And then like they'll play like a note. And so many years later, they play a note. I remember reading about it when I was in college and I printed off a little thing when I was in the computer lab and was like, this is amazing.
Okay, I wonder if that's going to pay off someday.
Yeah. Never will all be dead. It's yeah. great. I love it.
That last day there are like, there's two people that are like, what's going on? Yeah. We did it! Yay!
I'm going to ask our Venusian overlords what they think.
Yeah.
Mike.
Still going human. Oh.
What do you got in the realm of Earth? Yeah.
Speaking of mic hogging, today I'll have another example of Mike-stalgia. I was but a lad. I got tired of reading anthologies for grown-ups, and I decided to break into full novels. Ooh. But for some reason, lost in the midst of time, I settled on Stephen King as my intro to cool adult literature. I started with Pet Sematary, which I didn't like at all, but I followed that up with, I don't know, The Shining, I guess, which I loved. Anyway, yada yada yada, I eventually went to his anthologies, and in Four Past Midnight, there was this amazing poem at the very beginning. In the desert, I saw a creature, naked, bestial, who squatting upon the ground, held his heart in his hands, and ate of it. I said, is it good, friend? It is bitter. Bitter, he answered. But I like it, because it is bitter, and because it is my heart. And then I was like, what? I thought poetry was all about boring stuff like beauty and Grecian urns. You mean there could also be poems about monsters eating their own hearts and unending bitterness and sorrow? Oh, boy.
That's why we didn't start with you today.
You guys. Oh, man. Come on, guys. We're all black and, like, you know. This isn't The Cure with me. Where has poetry been all my life? I said. That's a bad segue. Anyway, this is the poem In the Desert by Stephen Crane. Oh, bad editing. Crane was a journalist in the late
19th
century.
It's a Cajun poem based on chance.
There you go.
Yeah. There you go.
Death.
And sorrow. Crane was a journalist in the late 19th century who is best known today for his Civil War novel, The Red Badge of Courage, which is widely regarded as one of the greatest American novels of all time. I haven't read it, but I've heard that his poems share a lot of the same traits, a kind of dim view on naivete, a kind of bitter outlook on life, and a focus on the cruel indifference of nature. We have a copy of his poems in the collection, and I'll recommend that you enjoy them slowly, like a lemon sour after a full meal. They tend to be very short, but have a rather dark outlook, like Crane was a proto-proto-proto-goth, or something. So, I thought I'd end a little early. Before I go, I thought I'd leave with a poem that is kind of happy, called Should the Wide World Roll Away. Should the wide world roll away, leaving black terror, limitless night, nor God, nor man, nor place to stand, would be to me essential, if thou and thy white arms were there, and the fall to doom a long way. Worry.
Wow. How do you follow that, Rich?
You got a fruit pun now, man?
Yeah, that's right.
Jeez.
Yeah, this is why I put off doing it for 2 years. It's like every time it's like, hey, guys, let's do Poetry Month. I'm like, well, I like Stephen Crane. Wait, I should do something that's semi-kind of happy.
That one was really pared down.
That was the happy
one. You started them.
I like that. I like that you cherry picked one of his lighter poems.
Yeah. Oh, pineapple.
Pine advice. Startable.
Sounds like Mr. Crane had a prickly personality.
Oh snap! This is so distracting. Can we just finish? Can we?
All right.
Man, go on.
I stopped listening.
Man, go on. Okay. I wanted to talk about the poetry of rock and roll, because that's maybe a little closer to my... Closer to the heart. With rock and roll, you got your Bob Dylans and your Lou Reeds, but music lyrics, song lyrics, are not necessarily analogous to poetry. And I didn't want to do it, but I got to do it. In his book, Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink, Elvis Costello.
I was going to say, if you say Elvis Costello, I'm throwing something at
you. Just one paragraph.
John Cage, Elvis Costello.
It's just one paragraph.
I've never talked about John Cage.
It's just one paragraph. It's just one paragraph, and then I'm moving on. Just one paragraph,
and then I'm
moving
on. What was that woman's book that he recommended four times?
Didn't mention it. I just said I was looking forward to it, by God. And then I read it, and I said, hey, I liked it. Eat it. In his book, Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink, Elvis Costello himself, a noted wordsmith, asserts that the difference between poetry and lyrics is huge because the lyrics are meant to be sung and might not hold up away from the context of the song when they're isolated from their music. And they're also sort of beholden maybe to the genre and the tune and all of this. But then in his book, he uses his own lyrics to sort of supplement the stories he tells of his life, so it's a little bit of a contradiction. But I think there is some pretense to poetic art, or what there's pretense to poesy in his work. The cover of his last album, 2013's Wise Up Ghost, is modeled on the cover of Allen Ginsberg's Howl. It's a direct lift, and there's this beat sort of connection is evident in the pseudo-slam poetry delivery of songs of his like Hurry Down, Doomsday, The Bugs Are Taking Over from 1991's Mighty Like a Rose, and Episode of Blonde from 2002's When I Was Cruel. But whether these lyrics hold up outside the context of their recordings is up to you to decide, so no, I guess. If nothing else, Mark Rebo's solo on Hurry Down, Doomsday is amazing. Elvis, done. Done, Elvis. No more Elvis.
Well, you're not going to talk about anything else, right?
My mind is elsewhere. It's taking a plane.
On the flip side, we have the Violent Femmes' Gordon Gano, who is a Lou Reed acolyte. He took this sort of poetry approach a step further by using actual poetry, not his own, as song lyrics. He adapted the poetry of German writer Walter Mehring into two songs from the band's 1994 album, New Times. It was the title track and another song called Agamemnon. The following year, he pulled this trick again with the lyrics for the song I Danced, coming from Australian poet Max Dunn. This was on their album Rock, which was only released in Australia, but yours truly received a copy in the mail because I wrote their fan club and said, hey, can I get some things? And they sent me a copy of that. Humble brag.
Your awesomeness often blows me away
from
the table.
Lame brag. But it's also available on their greatest hits compilation, Permanent Record. This is sort of the flip side of the Elvis issue raised above, where he's sort of maybe writing his own poetry and turning it into music. The Violent Femmes were using poetry and putting it in their music. It doesn't necessarily translate that great, but it's an interesting exercise. But let's forget all this pretentious claptrap. I said it once on a previous show. I will say it again. I think Surfing Bird is the greatest song of all time. Its lyrics are gospel. Bapa Hu Mau Mau is a divine chant. But while we're at it, let's talk about a chant of another kind, and that is da-do run run. If you say it three times while looking in a mirror, your hair will transform into a dandelion and a cadre of lovely ladies. They'll start singing to you. You might also end up murdering someone. Da-do Run Run was written by Jeff Barry, Ellie Greenwich, and Phil Spector and performed by The Crystals and released as a single 53 years ago in March 1963. The words...
It's April now.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Still 53 years ago, son.
In like 4 days.
Yeah.
Get it right.
Man, it's fun.
Now, the words Do-do-run-run were just used as the composers originally as placeholders. They were sort of sibilant syllables to stand in place for words which are actually spoken by humans. But when they recorded it, the story goes that Phil Spector liked it so much when he heard it that he decided to keep it. And this is kind of a thing that people do. I think famously Paul McCartney wrote the melody.
Yeah,
he wrote the melody for Yesterday and was just like singing Scrambled Eggs, How I Love My Lady's Legs or whatever. And
That happens a lot. Yeah, it's kind of a standard songwriting.
Yeah,
fashion.
It's very useful.
Chopping broccoli.
Yeah, exactly. But they don't usually end up in the song. But that the brilliance of that nonsense, don't let that dim the rest of the song. There's poetry throughout in lines like, I met him on a Monday and my heart stood still. The do run run, the do run run. Somebody told me that his name was Bill. And then just repeat it, and it's brilliant. The ghost of Percy Shelley is kicking himself for not coming up with that one. Look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair indeed. So there's all kinds of ink spilled on Dylanology and the Randian overtones in Neil Peart's lyrics, but that is silly. Burn your notebooks.
I thought Coleridge did Ozymandias.
No. Shelley.
Yes, Shelley. I looked it up, man.
Catalog.
Coleridge did Xanadu.
Yeah.
Xanadu. So you can burn. Yes. Burn your notebooks. Clear the road less traveled. There's a thousand new Dylans typing on a thousand typewriters could never come up with the nonsense howled by Barry, Greenwich, and Spector, the greatest minds of their generation.
I got it.
I enjoy your hyperbole.
Yeah. I got your Ginsberg reference. All right. I'm so glad I have to follow that up. Should have made you go. Should have made you went last.
Went
in. Go what? Huh? All that might get cut.
Jeremy said, "I like poetry." That's
in episode correction. I talked about John Cage in July
2011.
Well,
so that was your alternative universe that you didn't talk about it. So we were in the
I talked about his book Silence, which is a great companion piece to Diary. Worth checking out.
Yeah,
all right.
That was 5 years ago. You shouldn't have to remember that.
Now, for my segment for today, that was 7 years ago. Wait, I don't know. Nope. I don't remember.
This is the poetry.
Math
fail.
I don't remember college.
What year is this?
Now, for my segment for today is going to be a pale echo compared to Jeremy's, because I also am going to talk about things I've talked about before.
Oh.
And how pop music is often poetry.
Oh.
So, songs are poems. Duh, Mr. Costello. After the zombie apocalypse comes and society collapses, and the next society is picking up the pieces of our boink society, what's gonna be left over, right?
All these not brains, because the zombies will take it over.
These dusty, slim little chapbooks that are gathering mold in academic libraries.
Probably.
Right?
Yeah,
right?
They'll be the first to be burned. Because
we need to be warm. What do we need?
To the library. Let's burn useless chapbooks.
To the library.
Or.
We can eat paper.
Or.
Books are only half the fuel for the fire.
Or.
The rest are bodies.
Or the detritus of actually popular culture, like thousands of David Bowie LPs and Britney Spears CDs. With this in mind, I'm going to give a short appreciation of the poetry of Britney Spears, or perhaps Max Martin.
She didn't write any of that.
Listeners know that I recently enjoyed the book Song Machine Inside the Hit Factory. This book led me to explore artists I'd previously overlooked, for instance, the young Ms. Spears. And, as I said before, I learned that a lot of Britney songs are just barely songs.
Does she really need to be hit one more time?
She keeps going, so apparently yes.
Yeah. We'll get to that. Songs.
Oh, preview. Spoiler.
The songs and the lyrics are like pared down to their barest elements. They just like barely kind of hang together. And I think her first hit, Baby One More Time, is one of the best examples of this. Here's a little piece.
Ding, ding, ding.
Oh, baby,
baby. Toxic is awesome.
I saw Nickel Creek play that in concert one night. Like, they did Toxic. It was the best ever.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Show me how you want it to be. Tell me, baby. Because I need to know now. Oh, because my loneliness is killing me. And I must confess, I still believe.
Still believe!
All right.
When I'm not with you, I lose my mind. Give me a sign. Hit me, baby.
One more time.
One more time.
One more time.
Bing, bing, bing.
Those are barely sentences. The song was... The song was written by Max...
I said it's very Max Martin.
It's written by Max Martin, who is obsessive, not about the content of the lyrics, but their form. He demands that the lyrics, down to the syllable, conform to the structure of the music. This makes his songs very poetic. Astute listeners may have noticed the song's title is Baby One More Time, but the hook actually is Hit Me. Baby, one more time.
So if the title advocated, like, abuse, that would be bad. But the song
advocated... That's why they changed it.
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
Surely this cannot mean hit, as in punch or strike. This is a metaphor for something else. Drugs, sex, the euphoria of junk food, the emotional euphoria of intimacy.
A long game of 21.
Wow. Like, her dress as a schoolgirl through the whole thing just makes it even grosser.
Is
only
this
like 15?
Is
that's kind of legal in some places.
It's mostly legal.
The movie was directed by Gregory Dark, who's a porn director. Okay, is this hit a positive or negative experience? There are a lot of ways to interpret it, or to put it another way, I took the one less traveled by, and that made all the difference.
Frosty. Really?
Yeah.
Why don't we talk about Elvis Costello some more?
I thought you guys would have some good riffs on that. So as I was listening to these very poetic pop songs, I couldn't help but to think of my favorite David Bowie album, Low. The lyrics on this record are often described as haiku. When I first played this record for my friends, they ask, where are the songs? Which is pretty much the experience I had when I intentionally listened to Baby One More Time for the first time. And the song on Low that it really reminded me of is Always Crashing in the Same Car. Here's a bit. Every chance that I take, I take it on the road. These kilometers and the red lights. I'm always looking left and right. Oh, but I'm always crashing in the same car. Again, I think this is a metaphor. He's driving around and round, but he's still caught in the same self-destructive loop. Oh, but I'm always crashing in the same car. Give me a sign. Hit me, baby, one more time. These are two different songs that are about the same thing. People caught in self-destructive, repetitive behaviors. So who's going to survive the zombie apocalypse? Britney Spears, David Bowie, Allen Ginsberg,
David Bowie's not.
Lisa Robinson. I don't know.
Well, zombie apocalypse, he could come back, you know.
That's true.
Talking about their work, man. Don't be
so
literal.
Sorry.
This is the poetry episode. Think metaphorically.
Will the aliens go for a guy who played an alien? Or?
Now, of course, talking about song lyrics on the poetry episode is punting. I wanted to talk about Dennis Johnson's book of poetry, The Incognito Lounge, but I checked it out and kept it so long until it was billed for it and had to give it back. All right. Happy Poetry Month. Read a poem. Hey, guys.
Hey, Brian.
Hey, Brian. Hey, Brian.
What do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Well,
maybe the library has it.
Maybe the library doesn't, but either way, it's tickling our fancy.
Amanda.
Okay, I have recently made the best musical discovery of all time.
Ooh.
One of the tracks I was listening to at work was called, on my EDM channel, was called Sunset Over, I don't know how to say this, I'm sorry, Manan, it looks like Canaan, but with an M, by Atlas, and it featured a dialogue from Star Wars. Wow. And I kept hearing Leia and Han talking, and I thought, oh, this is fun. So over the next couple of days, it kept popping up, and I finally gave in and tracked down the source of this delightful track. And it actually comes from a brand new release called Star Wars Headspace, which initially, you know, I thought this was just, you know, kind of one of those throw-off albums you find in the free bin at McKay's. But a little research...
6 years later.
Yeah, yeah. Like, this came out in 1974, and it's just been waiting for me to find it.
Huzzah!
But a little research revealed that each track was done by a current prominent EDM artist like Royksopp or Bonobo or Atlas, and the whole thing was actually produced by Rick Rubin. So these are some pretty big names for an album like this, I think.
Yeah. Wow.
So you mean those samples were legal?
They were legal. And This was released on Hollywood Records just this past February, and it actually debuted at number one on Billboard's Dance Electronic Albums chart.
Whoa.
The record is typical. It's typical EDM fare, but at its center, it contains samples of dialogue and sound effects from all the Star Wars films. You can hear R2-D2, C-3PO, spaceships, and lots of other recognizable sounds. It's fun to try to go through and pick them all out.
I don't know who you are or where you came from.
Han Solo. I'm captain of the Millennium Falcon.
Only you could be so bold.
I got a bad feeling about this.
What you won't hear, which wasn't legal, is any of John Williams' score, because Lucasfilm forbid Ruben and his producers from using any of the music.
Beep boop.
So, no Darth Vader tune. But the super bestest part of this best discovery is that the library has this album. The physical CD is currently on order. It actually may be in by the time this posts, so get your hold on it now. Or we do have it on Hoopla as well. Nice. So if you are any kind of Star Wars fan, you have to listen to these tracks simply to guess what the sound effects are and see how they use them to make music, because that's very awesome.
I really like the, it came out in the 70s, but it's like Miko, the Star Wars Galactic Funk.
The library used to have that.
Yeah, we used to have that.
I don't know if we still do.
And now we've got this one to replace that if we don't have that one.
It's pretty amazing. I used to have the record I found at the Goodwill, but I gave it away.
Sad face.
Just thinking like, you know, search your heart. You know it to be true. I am your father. Drop the force. No! This year,
Mike's version.
I must find the rebel base. Rebel base.
Music inspired by Star Wars and other galactic funk by Miko is available on Hoopla. That is basically, if you guys don't know it, it's like the Italo disco version of Star Wars soundtrack. It's awesome.
Oh, nerf herder. This year, I decided to try out the Tournament of Books, which is kind of a March Madness for books from a website called The Morning News and co-sponsored by Powell's Books. It's been kind of a mixed bag for me. Of the ones I read, three I really, really liked. Three I found kind of meh, and two can go to hell.
Tell us how you really feel.
Previously, I recommended The Story of My Teeth, which was eliminated in one of the early brackets, and today I thought I'd recommend The Czar of Love and Techno by Anthony Mara. It's a series of interlocking short stories, all with a different main character, that are set in Russia, starting in 1937 in the Soviet Union, stretching to the late 90s Chechnya, and ending in a dying industrial town near the Arctic Circle. One of my favorite things, books like this, which I keep hoping they'll do on TV, and they never, ever, 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 ever will, is dropping in references to other stories. You know, characters and objects overlap throughout the book. I get excited every time. Ooh, references for me. Ooh, that's a character from the first story, I would exclaim. And be all delighted to see him in a background character five stories later. Ooh, that's a poem from the second story. Ooh, exciting. Of course, you can't do that in television, because television is new television. The tone is very Russian, both bleak yet funny, fatalist yet kind of hopeful. My only real complaint is that the last story sucks. But other than that...
King skip that.
Good stuff.
It was 97% really good.
4.5 out of 5.
So it's a collection of interconnected short stories.
Yeah,
I like that.
The folks at Parnassus really loved that book. They really pushed it when it came out. Yeah. It might have been. I think it was Anne herself. Was like, this is my.
Yeah, I think that was her favorite book of the year.
Yeah, this was
So if they ever have him come in there, I would totally get it signed.
Very cool.
So what comic book do you have, Jeremy? I only said it because he said it's coming up.
No. I was talking about comics before. I'm not talking about. I'm talking about a film. Tickling my fancy this week is Crystal Lake Memories, The Complete History of Friday the 13th. It's two discs. It's 6.66666 hours.
Whoa, metal.
This is a movie by movie, by TV show, by exposed bosom, by... kill,
yeah,
history,
creative murder, and hockey mask.
Yeah, of the seminal slasher film Friday the 13th, and however many they've made. I've been watching it very slowly because it's six. It says it's 400 minutes, and I did the math, and it is like 6.66 and more sixes hours. long, and it's a pretty standard documentary. Interviews with the cast and behind-the-scenes production stuff, box office receipts and stuff. But it's narrated by Corey Feldman.
I don't want to scare anyone, but I'm going to give it to you straight about Jason.
To me, he's the most fearsome, awesome, indestructible, mysterious figure in movie history.
The fans so adore this character. They like Jason more than they like the survivors.
The best horror movies find a way to tap into something that's truly human.
We don't know why, but it's something in us that likes to be scared.
Still to this day, it was the most terrifying thing I've ever shot.
I don't watch the movie. I pick somebody out in the audience and then watch the evolution of their heart attack.
The people just flew out of the seats and ran out of the theater.
The modern horror movie was kind of born.
The parents didn't watch it, which only made you want to see it that much more.
That's where the power lies, is Jason. Jason never dies because the audience brings him back to life.
Terror struck across my face, my heart. Everybody took me out. Like, are you okay? Are you okay? No, I'm not okay.
Friday the 13th, the very first film, which is the best, has a special spot in my heart. Because it was the only VHS that my family owned for many years before
really?
before we even had a VCR. For some reason, we had a copy of this, and it seems like they were always on television, like on TBS or whatever. Because I guess it was always Halloween when I was a child. And
Sounds like an ideal thing for me.
Maybe everything was just scary when I was a child.
Oh yeah, there's that.
But I also really liked the TV series, which was like had nothing to do with Jason, but was a horror anthology show.
It's weirdly fun, even though it really, like, you know, other than the title.
Well, they mentioned, I
thought there was some sort of tie-in, but
they,
I asked somebody who's a super fan, and they said no.
Not at all. The title was used to sell the series, and then that was it. There was a haunted antique store, and the
they sold, like, cursed antiques, and they had to track them down.
But, like, David Cronenberg directed an episode.
He's incredibly Canadian.
Yeah, it's great. Roby was on it. I loved it. And like we'd watch the movies and get all scared, and my stepdad would do the that was great. It wasn't great because he was trying to scare me and my brother because he was drunk, but otherwise it was great.
Great family time.
I love it. And I'm slowly watching it because you know you can watch it in chunks, and it's very entertaining.
I agree. I think the first one is the best.
I liked. I think it's four. With Corey Feldman is pretty good.
I kind of liked Freddy vs. Jason.
I never saw that one.
I liked it.
I think I've seen everything up to.
Oh, Jason X.
I did see Jason X.
Moving on. Jason X. Of course, the first Friday the 13th is the best one. Of course. All right.
Not necessarily.
Okay. Oh. You forced my hand, Michael.
Oh, well.
So what's tickling my fancy this week is that I got my hands on a pre-pub galley of The Incantations of Daniel Johnson, a graphic novel illustrated by Richard Cavolo and written by my man in West Virginia, Scott McClanahan.
Ooh.
And you guys, longtime listeners may remember that I think probably last year what I was looking forward to this year, maybe the year before that, was Scott McClanahan's Sarah book. I don't know when that's coming out, but probably not until summer will The Incantations of Daniel Johnson come out, but I got my hands on a copy, and I'm super-duper excited about it. It's tickling my fancy, and I got to tell you, I am not a fan of Daniel Johnson. Does someone on the podcast want to do, like, two-sentence thing about who Daniel Johnson is?
Beanie Motorcycle!
He is, like, a mentally ill singer-songwriter who writes very, like, painful and childlike songs, like one called Speeding Motorcycle, and has long been loved by people, but is a difficult... And there was a movie about him called The Devil and Daniel Johnson.
Okay.
Johnston.
That was two sentences for sure, even though how many conjunctions you put in there.
It's a run-on. So,
and we have a graphic novel that we called Space Ducks.
Semicolon, semicolon.
Okay.
It's Johnston.
So, thank you. You're right. So, never been a fan... And I'm not, I've never, this, even, and there's a lot of debates around, like, you know, who's in control of his career and is it being exploited? I think we brought this up and talked about Wesley Willis, right?
Okay.
And, but
I think he's maybe, well, anyway.
It's my understanding, I haven't dug into it yet, that this book explores all that.
Yeah.
Right?
That's cool.
And I'm kind of excited about it. And Richard Cavolo's art is really amazing. It's like childlike, but like over maximalized, like maximalist childlike stuff. It looks really cool. Now, why, Mike, you forced my hand?
Yeah, because that's where I came in.
I think it was last year Scott McClanahan was in the Tournament of Books, and he dropped out on purpose and said it's BS.
Interesting.
And then, of course, there are all these think pieces about how Scott McClanahan's an evil child that's ruining literature, and I was watching from the sidelines laughing my butt off. And Scott McClanahan's, my esteem for Scott McClanahan just kept getting higher and higher and higher.
Even the commentators at the Tournament of Books who, like, been following it since it started, and they love it all. It's like, yeah, this really doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
Apparently the prize is an actual live rooster if you show up to, I guess, wherever the morning news is. No one has claimed it because who wants a live rooster?
I was going to say, that's really not the bestest reward you could come up with. Unless you're on a farm, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's not even good eating.
I guess Scott McClanahan didn't win it. Cock-a-doodle-doo!
Cock-a-doodle-don't!
Callback.
The Incantations of Daniel Johnson by Richard Cavolo and Scott McClanahan.
I'll keep abreast of it.
Hope it doesn't suck. Haven't read it yet. Okay.
When does it come out?
I think July.
Because that looks really cool.
I think July.
Who is publishing it?
$2 Radio.
Oh.
An actual indie press.
Yeah.
Woo!
So, but not a comic press.
Hey, seriously, support your indie press. Buy some poetry books.
I've got one, two, one,
seven.
And a half. I said Daniel Close, and I believe it's Daniel Klaus. I never, when I was talking about Art School Confidential, I always think that it is the one that's not what it is.
So apparently it sounds like a shrill German.
Yes, Klaus.
Klaus.
And, and what's so funny is I heard Mark Maron mention him on WTF because he's going to be on WTF, and then I was listening to the Dinner Party Download on Friday night when I was leaving, and he was on there too, and both of them said Klaus, and I was like, well, so sorry about that. Also, Brian, this was a comment. You're reading my comment?
No.
You when you were talking about Donnie Darko, you said a young Jenna Malone. And she was a teenager, but she's like 31. And so it just makes it sound like, you know, like a young Patty Duke, R.I.P. or something.
She's 31 at the time?
No, she's 31 now.
Oh, okay.
Which I would say is young.
But
was like a teenager.
13 years ago?
No, I understand. But like it just made it sound like she's old now. A young Ellen Burstyn or something.
Mm. Okay.
Or a young Elaine Stritch.
A foxy gentleman.
So anyway, that's not a correction. That's just me sort of adding information to what you said.
My real corrections to Donnie Darko are so much more meaty. I said that Maggie Gyllenhaal played Donnie's sister. I never named her, but then later I called her Elizabeth. Like, I never said.
Is it S. Darko?
His younger sister is Samantha. His older sister is Elizabeth.
Oh.
The one that gets
accepted. Another sister.
There's two sisters in Donnie Darko. Huh.
So that could be another movie.
There was.
E. Darko.
Yeah.
They did S. Darko.
I feel this. So that was a little confusing. And then also, my joke that failed that I will now explain, which proves that it was not funny.
Which makes it a Mike-ism.
Or in 3 to 4 weeks, we'll all
I'll
get
figure it out.
So the plan was, I say, all right, the movie I'm going to talk about is, and then you guys say Dazed and Confused. And then I say, nope. Donnie Darko. That was how that was supposed to go.
I see. I was blanking on the name. Time. I was like, it's that movie with Matthew McConaughey I haven't seen.
It's a.
Well, I was trying to
you're
think.
Half right.
Like, Dazed and Confused isn't about college.
Yeah, it's about high school.
That's what, yeah, that's what I was trying to.
Yeah, I was like, obviously, you mean everybody wants some exclamation point.
It was all that this, one all is this, about all this setup. It's
college.
Not about college. Some people don't have to go to college, but it's all this setup for Dazed and Confused. You guys just dropped the ball on me.
We overthought it.
Sorry.
Let me say what I screwed up, but I turned the tables on you.
Yeah. Well done.
Was there anything else about that? I don't think so. Yeah, one more. I said that the 80s hits were recontextualized. They are not. They weren't really. They're all diegetic to the movie and make perfect sense.
Whoa.
The
one
that's
a $2 word.
The one
diegetic.
That,
nice.
The one that is.
Better than analytic.
Are they?
The one that is actually recontextualized somewhat is the song Mad World, which was originally by Tears for Fears, but the version on the soundtrack was covered by Gary Jules and Michael Andrews, who was the composer of the film. And they turned it into a piano ballad, amazing version of the song that a lot of people love, kind of became a minor hit on their own. That version is recontextualized. I'm always kind of sloppy. Any more corrections?
I was just thinking that maybe sometimes I may be a little too dismissive of Amanda. I can't remember, like, what I said. Or what you said.
We
I didn't write that
down.
I
don't know what context
you
mean.
I was like, whatever. So next time I'm surprised by something Amanda likes, I will say no.
Wow.
You know.
Shit's getting real.
I mean, what
I don't remember what
exactly?
It was, though. I didn't write it down.
Like, me and Amanda don't like anything
no.
The same
no.
At all. Well, I'm trying to think. Yeah,
that's
like
not true. You both
we like Donnie Darko.
Oh, you didn't like Melissa.
Yeah. I hated Maleficent.
Yeah, you both hate Wes Anderson. Everybody hates Wes Anderson, but
I don't hate Wes Anderson.
I don't hate Wes Anderson, but I don't like him anymore.
Yeah.
Too.
Like, Rushmore, awesome movie. Royal Tenenbaums, awesome movie. And then he hasn't made a different movie.
Yeah.
So
that's kind of. I like Royal Tenenbaums, but he lost me after that.
Yeah.
I feel like now he's trying too hard to achieve the success he had previously.
Bruising my soul, guys.
I've not liked it.
Now, I've got to go back because everyone tells me I need to go back. Because
I enjoy it. He's got a style.
Isn't he do Grand Budapest?
Yeah,
I heard that. I heard that one was really good.
See, he's got a style, and I like it.
I fell asleep during that movie. I couldn't watch it.
I didn't even try.
Andy didn't like Scott Pilgrim versus the World. See, we have differences.
We
have differences, gang.
I liked Scott Pilgrim. I just didn't think it was very good.
I didn't think the movie I think it was written very well.
Yeah, it was like it was all right, but it was.
I felt like it had so much more potential. than the movie was.
Someone asked me if I saw Batman versus Superman. I just laughed.
My husband is my husband is killing me to go. Like,
are you didn't?
Because we moved this weekend, so we're otherwise engaged.
Oh, okay.
He got you to Deadpool, and now he's like, I've got you.
Because what I want to do is I want him to go to Superman, and I'm going to go to my Big Fat Greek Wedding.
That sounds like a plan. No. You should totally do that.
We'll both go together. Yes. Well, my dad's coming down this weekend, so he might kidnap my dad to go.
I liked the original my Big Fat Greek Wedding. Surprisingly.
I just watched it this weekend to prepare. So
what?
I did not
work. Wait a second. I know we've got
Batman
a whole other
Superman
show.
Superman is the worst.
Wow.
Yeah, spray Windex in the face.
Just put some Windex on it.
Yeah, wow. Totally.
All right.
It's charming. Sometimes I like charming.
Wow.
Opa.
The last movie I saw with my partner was The Witch. All right.
Yeah.
More information about
Witch. Would you like some butter?
Oh, it's so good. For more information, Amanda, don't go see that one.
I'm good. I don't go see 90% of what you guys talk about.
So. No, like, of all the most, like, it's hard to make a horror movie that's creepy nowadays. The Witch is so good. Okay. For more information about witches and scary horror movies, you can go to www.editthis, because it was all just a bunch of nonsense. Now I jest.
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
You can subscribe to the Pop Medic Podcast on iTunes.
RSS
Stitcher.
Feeds. And Stitcher.
Yeah, both. Next week.
Library Week!
We're going meta.
Yeah, check it out,
gang.
We're going meta.
Some library stuff about library
stuff. We're going to podcast at the library about podcasts at the library.
It'll be totally fine.
I've been to so many panels and conferences about that kind of thing. You have no idea.
It'll be bore-hazing. Boring.
Can you turn that into a fruit?
Wow.
Bore-hazing.
Mike's going to do
Luis Abrito.
A 40-minute podcast. Cataloging lesson. It's going to be great.
Okay, gang, we're going to start with 001.
Aliens?
That is information.
Information.
Aliens are up there, too.
How come everything doesn't just go in information? Because isn't it all information?
Well, 001 became like a kind of miscellaneous grab bag.
Miscellaneous.
Yeah. If in doubt, 001.
So computers got thrown in there and random info and... aliens. Unexplained phenomenon.
Aliens.
Oh,
yeah.
It goes computers into aliens.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
I love it.
That's the row I walk by every day to get to my office.
Hotheads everywhere.
Can't believe you read that.
So I just don't think that the stereotypes that people have about his music really reflects the way that he really was. But if a recording of his work isn't something that you really want to hear, you could read his book, The Silence, which kind of lays out his theories. And the book itself, The Silence, is itself a work of art. Like, the typography is amazing. Like, when he wrote essays and poetry, you know, they were never just normal on the page. Like, you know, all the shape of the text and the font and everything is a total work of art. You could read that book like it was poetry and philosophy and not have to sit through an opera singer singing an aria in 5 different languages with 10 people dialing random things on transistor radios, right? So, but you could, you know, the book, I think, is very enlightening.